The Soviet Union has a global strategy. The West in general, and the U.S. in particular, does not. For the past 25 years, the United States has made a serious strategic miscalculation in failing to appreciate that Africa is a theater of power. Moscow, on the other hand, realized this long ago. Unless drastic steps are taken soon, the Soviet Union will be able to achieve her aim of world domination simply by the threat of her ever-increasing massive military might, plus the skillful technique of revolutionary war by proxy forces, using Cuban and East Bloc Warsaw Pact mercenaries. In the preface to his book, Bear at the Back Door, General Sir Walter Walker warns, "The Soviet Union intends to absorb the whole of southern Africa, including its great mineral wealth, to dominate the Cape Sea Route, the Red Sea, the Persian Gulf, and the Indian Ocean. This will bring NATO to its knees without firing a shot. Instead of supporting the countries that are actively opposed to Moscow's expansionist designs, the U.S. is cravenly competing for the favor of the Soviet Union's puppet regimes in the hope that they can be wooed away from the fatal Kremlin bear hug." Close quote. The world may have to pay dearly for the incredible lack of foresight in the African area of U.S. foreign policy. But I'm getting ahead of my story. I first became interested in Africa while working as a missionary to the communist world of Eastern Europe. I was interested in studying communism, not only to find out its weak points, but to expose the inadequacies of its strengths and thereby lead people to faith in Jesus Christ, the way, the truth, and the life. I looked at the long-range goals of communism and their strategy for attaining those goals. It was at that point that I suddenly realized how important Africa is to the Soviet Union and how absolutely imperative southern Africa is to the Kremlin's plan of world domination. I also learned how vital South Africa is to the survival of the West and the free world. The objective of this tape is to give you a clear presentation of the facts so that you may reach an intelligent conclusion and have a better understanding of Africa. Africa is commonly called the Dark Continent. I used to think this referred to the color of skin for the majority of people, but it is more likely due to the lack of any thoroughly reliable historical records going back more than 500 years, and in most cases, less than that. Egypt is, of course, the great exception, with its many millennia of detailed data, but southern Africa is relatively new. When Jan van Riebeck and his company of Dutchmen landed at Table Bay on the southern tip of Africa to establish a food and supply station for merchant ships en route around the Cape of Good Hope from Europe to India, the whole of southern Africa was a vast and empty land. By the 19th century, five other European nations had established colonies in Africa: France, Britain, Belgium, Portugal, and Germany. The colonial powers were beginning to jostle one another during the latter half of the century, so in 1875 they convened a conference in Berlin to agree on boundaries for their African territories. Representatives of all the six European powers were present at the Berlin conference, but as far as the record shows, not one black African nation was represented, even though it was their land that was being divided up. Most of the present-day map of African state boundaries reflects the agreements reached at the Berlin Conference. borders were more often than not simply straight lines drawn across the face of the continent without any thought given to the nations of people living in an area this line might divide. Occasionally, a border would follow a natural geographical barrier, like a river or mountain range, and this would divide nations in a logical manner. But that was more by accident than by design, since the colonial powers did not consider the people whose lives would be affected by their lines drawn arbitrarily on a map. It must be pointed out that the Dutch were not considered colonialists, but settlers, much the same as the Pilgrims who settled in New England 30 years earlier. They did not displace anyone. The land was virgin and spread out for hundreds of miles in every direction. They were farmers, boers, and worked very hard. Soon they had a thriving settlement at Cape Town, and ships from many nations traded all sorts of goods and merchandise for food. Eventually, the British became envious of the beautiful farms and rich vineyards and felt they could run things better than the clumsy boers. After all, every Englishman knew he was born to rule. The Dutch were farmers, not fighters, and the land was big and beckoned, so they moved inland, and the great trek was underway. By the time they reached what is known today as the Witwatersrand, they had met the Zulu and other black nations migrating down from the north. The trek stopped, and they settled into the Pretoria-Johannesburg area. But it was a big mistake. Without realizing it, Johannesburg was built right on top of the world's richest vein of gold. When the British found out, they said, "We'll have that too." Now the farmers had nowhere else to go. They couldn't return to the Cape. The redcoats were there. They couldn't move north. The black nations occupied those areas. They decided to fight for their land. And so you have, around the turn of this century, the Boer War. Farmers facing the best trained and equipped professional soldiers of Her Majesty's Imperial Army. In retrospect, it was one of those unnecessary wars fought between two nations with much in common, and could most likely have been avoided, given a little less arrogance on the Anglo side and a little less intransigence from the Boers, plus a little more determined diplomacy on the part of both. Now, if you charge that I'm oversimplifying things, I plead guilty. But I want you to hear from the Africans themselves in song and interview, and we have less than an hour on this tape. It would be a help for you to have a map of Africa before you just now. If that's not possible, then just visualize the continent of Africa divided into roughly three layers. The top, or northern third of the continent, is composed mainly of Muslim countries that are, with the exception of Egypt, armed by the Soviets. So it's fair to say that Moscow controls the northern part of Africa militarily, even if those countries have not embraced Marxism yet. Stretching across the middle layer is a belt of quasi-communist countries, either completely red, like Congo-Brazzaville, or sufficiently sympathetic to act as host to a variety of rabble tourist groups, chief among them the African National Congress, or ANC. This includes Zambia, Tanzania, Uganda, and to a certain extent, Zaire. The southern part of that middle layer is completely communist: Angola, Zimbabwe, and Mozambique. The three join borders and stretch right across the continent, from the Atlantic to the Indian Ocean. These three are also part of the so-called frontline states and are committed to the spreading of communist ideology and tyranny into the rest of southern Africa. Angola serves as a base for SWAPO terrorists to launch attacks against Southwest Africa, Namibia, while Mozambique harbors occasional ANC groups that harass South Africa. So that leaves the third and southernmost layer, comprised of Southwest Africa, Namibia, and South Africa, still in the free world. These countries are the prime target for communist advance for two basic reasons. One, the mineral wealth, and two, the trade route around the Cape of Good Hope. The loss of South Africa to the communist would be an irreversible and unmitigated disaster for the West, a tragedy from which the free world would not recover. Strong words? Well, I hope you'll stay with me to see if I can support this assertion. In 1977, I visited Southern Africa for the first time. Rhodesia was in a life-and-death struggle against communist forces closing in from the north and from the west and east. Sanctioned by their former friends, along whose side they had fought tyranny in two world wars, Rhodesia now stood virtually alone.
But we're all Rhodesians and we'll fight through thick and thin. We'll keep our land a free land, stop the enemy coming in. We'll keep them north of the Zambezi till that river's running dry. And this mighty land will prosper, for Rhodesians never die.
I returned from that trip with the absolute conviction that if we do not help our Rhodesian friends keep the communist north of the Zambezi River, we will never be able to keep them south of the Rio Grande. Rhodesia declared unilateral independence from Britain in 1965, much the same as America had done in 1776. Harold Wilson, the socialist prime minister of Britain, said it wouldn't last, but not having any redcoats to send out to suppress the Rhodesians, he referred the whole matter to the United Nations, a motley gang whose attention we were mercifully spared in 1776. This song about the Unilateral Declaration of Independence, or UDI, welded the nation together in 1965 and gave the Rhodesians courage and determination. You can see why it was banned in Britain on the BBC.
Since the wagon wheels rolled north, it has been many years. The country has been built and run by hardy pioneers. They fought the Matabele in many a hardship too. With flag unfurled, we'll tell the world and sing this song to you. And you can call us rebels and you can call us rogues. We were founded by an Englishman by the name of Cecil Rhodes. We fought for this dear land of ours, and many men did die. And we may have to fight again, so this is UDI. In her time of need, we stood behind the motherland. Our soldiers fought in Flanders Field and in the desert sand. In steaming jungles, we have fought a common enemy. These days have been forgotten since the days of victory. And you can call us rebels, you can call us rogues. We were founded by an Englishman by the name of Cecil Rhodes. We fought for this dear land of ours and many men did die. And we may have to fight again, so this is UDI. And now the sun is setting upon a great regime. The children all are leaving the nest where they were weaned. And now the youngest child has left the parent and the home. And it can prove its worth if it's only left alone. You can call us rebels, you can call us rogues. We were founded by an Englishman by the name of Cecil Rhodes. We fought for this dear land of ours and many men did die. And we may have to fight again, so this is UDI. We may have to fight again, so this is UDI.
The only country to openly come to Rhodesia's aid during her long and bitter war with the terrorist was South Africa. The Rhodesians were grateful and said so in song.
Thank you, South Africa.
Thank you for your kindness.
love from Rhodesia. La la la.
La 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 la.
Dank je voor je goedheid.
En liefde van Rhodesia. La la.
La 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 la.
Fathers.
Mothers.
Sisters.
Brothers. Friends and neighbors, we all say to you in South Africa, thank you for your kindness.
And love from Rhodesia. La la la.
But the war continued with increased Soviet aid to the communist terrorist and increased sanctions imposed by the U.S. In his address to the members of the American Bar Association in the spring of 1968, the late Dean Acheson declared, "The imposition of economic sanctions against the state of Rhodesia by the U.S. and other countries at the instigation of the United Nations constituted nothing less than barefaced aggression, unprovoked and unjustified by a single legal or moral principle." Close quote. The so-called Byrd Amendment of 1971 at least allowed the U.S. to purchase high-grade chrome ore from Rhodesia to the benefit of both countries. To the United States, because chrome is essential to making stainless steel and other high-technology products. To Rhodesia, because sale of chrome allows her to earn the foreign exchange she desperately needs to buy arms to defend herself against mounting terrorist attack. But even the Byrd Amendment was repealed a few years later under the Carter administration. The terrorists were amply supplied with communist guns and money, which in itself contravened all principles of international law, to say nothing of the UN Charter. Thus, our foreign policy put the seal of American approval on aggression and terrorism in Rhodesia that only served the Soviet interests. So that's how I found Rhodesia in 1977, on the first of many visits there. Rhodesia at war. A war she did not declare, a conflict she did not initiate, under attack by her neighbors, who had been armed by the Russians, trained by the Cubans, and to a large extent financed by the World Council of Churches. Rhodesia, target of the biggest power grab since the communists swallowed up Angola and Mozambique. I preached in churches of all denominations. They were multiracial. I noticed, however, that Christians seemed to prefer to worship with other members of their own race, but there were no regulations about this. One thing the believers had in common, both black and white, was utter amazement as to why so many of the West's churches, which are supposed to be anti-communist, continued to support communist-backed terrorists. You see, money given by the World Council of Churches to various liberation movements and so-called freedom fighters buys the bullets which have killed missionaries, pastors, priests, and nuns, not to mention countless Christians living in the bush. One of the most traumatic events happened in September 1978, when terrorists shot down a civilian airliner. This is how the Rhodesian Broadcasting Corporation broke the news.
Here is a roundup of the main news items of the day, read by Caroline Thornycroft. Salisbury. Combined Operations Headquarters reports that 10 of the survivors of the Viscount air disaster were shot dead at point-blank range by terrorists. A Combined Operations spokesman said that eyewitness reports prove that 18 passengers had survived the crash, and they were alive and well at 5:45 yesterday. Terrorists later approached the scene and ordered the shocked and numbed survivors to their feet. The terrorists then opened fire with communist-made AK assault rifles, and 10 of the passengers, as yet unnamed but 6 known to be women, died in a hail of fire.
Later, in the African service of the RBC, they broadcast this telephone interview with Joshua Nkoma, the communist terror leader. In response to the question, "Why did you shoot the plane down?" he replied,
"We shot down that plane because that plane has been ferrying military personnel and equipment to Kariba and Victoria Falls."
"How did you shoot the plane down?"
"By our equipment, of course."
"But using a missile?"
"No, never mind what we used, but we shot the plane down, that's the point."
Well, that's it. You've just heard the voice and satanic laugh of Joshua Nkoma, communist terror leader, claiming responsibility for shooting down an unarmed civilian airliner on a domestic scheduled flight within Rhodesia. A few days later, I traveled by car, without escort or convoy, over 250 miles through terrorist-occupied territory in order to interview two of the survivors of that crash. This is how I filed that report and interview for a subsequent radio broadcast. If you can, try to imagine the shock and trauma of being on board a civilian airliner flying between two cities in your own country. And suddenly there's an explosion. The starboard engine bursts into flames. The aircraft shudders and begins to descend rapidly. The pilot fights for control, radios his position, and instructs the passengers to prepare for an emergency landing. On impact, the plane breaks in two. You're in the back section. Dirt and dust are pouring in as you careen across the land and finally come to a halt. The noise was terrific, like 1,000 bombs exploding. Then, all is quiet. You're dazed, shocked, stunned. Then you hear the screams of those trapped in the other section of the aircraft as it bursts into flames. Will you be next? Miraculously, you escape. There are 18 altogether, shocked, dazed, but alive and grateful. 8 people go in 2 parties of 4 each to seek help. 10 remain with the plane. A short time later, terrorists emerge out of the bush. They are carrying automatic rifles, Russian-made AK-47s. At first, they appear friendly. They offer help. The 10 survivors are gathered together into a little group, and the communist terrorists open fire. Afterwards, they bayonet the lifeless bodies. One was a little girl, 4 years old. Beside her, a grandmother. Shannon Hargreaves, one of the 8 survivors, remembers.
And at Kariba, there was a little girl. She wasn't a pretty little girl. She could have only been about 4. But this little girl, she was on the plane with her brother and her granny. And the 2 children never got out the plane, but their granny did. And she was one of the ladies that was killed in the massacre. And you know, that little girl, she wasn't beautiful. She wasn't anything spectacular, but she was, to me, she was different because she was so nice. She had such a friendly nature. She'd go to breakfast in the morning and she'd order a breakfast for herself and little things like that, you know. And I could remember when we got onto that plane what that little girl was wearing. And it seemed so unfair to me that the other children were alive. You know, friends of ours have got children. And it seemed unfair that she had to die and there are other children alive. And then all of a sudden I realized, well, God took her for a purpose. He didn't take her for nothing. And where she's gone, she's going to be happy. Nothing can harm her again. And it was little things like that, the little Indian girls that were bayoneted. I could, you know, they had little yellow dresses on and brown sandals. And you can, these little things, they used to worry me so much. And then I realized, well, God saved us because he wanted us to tell the other people what it was like.
And that, of course, is the purpose of this tape, to tell you what it's like, so you'll have the information and the facts to understand Africa. It has been said that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. Now that cute little phrase leaves the final judgment to each individual's perspective. I think there's a better test. It's in the form of a simple question. What is the fruit of their activity? Our Lord Jesus said, "By their fruit ye shall know them." The men who are furthering the communist cause in Africa, men who are armed with the Soviets, trained with the Cubans, these men are not freedom fighters. Freedom does not follow in their wake, but murder, savagery, and enslavement. And they are not even fighters. They never engage the army or the security forces, except by ambush or landmines. After all, these men can fight back, and the so-called freedom fighters might get hurt. Instead, they prove their bravery by attacking unarmed black men and women and children, intimidating, torturing, maiming, and massacring the innocent, with the aim of terrorizing the population into submission. The more accurate term for these cowards is terrorist. They stop children attending school, often abducting them at gunpoint, forcing the boys into terrorist training, and the girls to become underage camp followers for the pleasure of the older soldiers. They destroy anything which could bring their fellow blacks any benefit or progress, and often commit acts of armed robbery for personal gain. Now, much is made in Western news media about the armed struggle for liberation. In reality, it's a group of black children driving an ox cart along a rural dirt road. Next moment, there is an ear-splitting blast, and all that is left is a few arms and legs. Or a white farmer is driving home with his wife and children. A hail of bullets from the bush means the end of a family that has lived and loved together. Or perhaps it's a midnight raid on a lonely, unarmed mission station. They hit and run. If the Rhodesian security forces pursue them over the border into Mozambique or Zambia, then there was an international outcry and aid poured in from member states of the UN for the victims of Rhodesian aggression. Nevertheless, for security reasons, it was necessary to make preemptive strikes across the border occasionally to take out a terrorist base that was preparing to raid Rhodesia. I was at Combined Operations Headquarters in Salisbury interviewing the Air Vice Marshal, Chris Doms, when such a preemptive strike took place. I copied the conversation between the lead pilot and Lusaka, the capital of Zambia, as the squadron entered Zambian airspace. I'm sorry for the poor quality of recording, but remember, this was a war.
Lusaka Tower, this is Green Leader. How do you read?
Same Green Tower.
Tower, this is Green Leader. This is a message for the station commander at Mumba from the Rhodesian Air Force. We are attacking the terrorist base at Westlands Farm at this time. This attack is against Rhodesian dissidents and not against Zambia. Rhodesia has no quarrel, repeat, no quarrel with Zambia or her security forces. We therefore ask you not to intervene or oppose our attack. However, we are orbiting your airfield at this time and are under orders to shoot down any Zambian Air Force aircraft which does not comply with this request and attempts to take off. Did you copy all that?
Copied.
Roger, thanks. Cheers.
That initial interchange was followed a few moments later by the Zambian controller radioing for permission to allow the civilian airliner to take off and for details of the Rhodesian aircraft's call sign.
Rhodesian Air Force 1181.
Go ahead.
And we stop it.
Can you confirm we can let our civil aircraft take off from here? You have no objection?
Roger, we have no objection there, but I advise you for the moment to stand by on that. I request that you hang on for about short while, half an hour or so.
I suppose, can you please keep listening watch on this as well, so that we ask you what you want to ask?
Roger,
what do I call you?
Green Leader.
Green Leader, Roger.
Thanks.
Shortly afterwards, the air traffic control pressures began building up. Two aircraft were on the ground wishing to take off, and an incoming Kenyan airline flight wanted landing clearance from the Zambian controller.
Go ahead.
Lusaka, anyway, for my civilian operation.
Roger D, if you would hang fire, I'll advise you shortly.
I have one to take off to the north, and if you have no objection, I have one to take off to the south, civilian, you know.
Yeah. Lusaka Tower, this is Greenleaf. Roger, I request you hold them for another 10 minutes. Thank you.
Positive Rhodesian control of Zambian airspace continued for as long as the raid lasted. It took out the base from which some of the terrorists operated who shot down the civilian Rhodesian airliner. Welcome to Side 2 in your quest to understand Africa. On Side 1, we looked at Africa in general and Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, in particular. In the remaining portion of this tape, we will concentrate on Southern Africa in general and South Africa in particular. You'll meet Africans of all races, black, white, colored, and Indian. They'll tell you their side of the story, and you'll be able to form an intelligent opinion based on facts instead of liberal media bias.
When you consider that Africa is made up of 52 countries, maybe three of them are still economically viable.
Ada Parker, writer, historian, journalist.
There are 150 million starving people on this continent. We are seeing genocide in Africa, such as humanity has never before seen. South Africa is the only really viable economy on the entire continent. Despite what the U.S. senators may think, it is really the most humane country in all Africa. The West, I think, has such a burden of guilt as far as Africa is concerned, because your own people, the Americans, they couldn't wait to break down the colonial systems. I've known Africa for many years. I've traveled very extensively in Africa. In 1960, Africa was the most peaceful continent on Earth, and it's now undoubtedly the most troubled continent on Earth. And a number of people must carry the blame for that. Those politicians who, for their own ends, wanted the old colonial empire authorities out, Britain, the Portuguese, French, Germans, and the Belgians. No matter what they say about those colonies, they were very well administered and nobody was starving. They were all food exporters. And I really do feel that many, many people in the West should feel a great sense of shame at what they have done, because they don't know what they're doing, but they're condemning a whole continent to death.
I spoke with black South African journalist John Gogosha. He was very upset with Bishop Tutu for encouraging school boycotts while Tutu and other hypocrites send their children abroad to private schools.
We have found that these people have been leading our children down the garden path, in the sense that their children were in much poorer schools, white schools, private schools, and they were instigating the children of the poorer people to boycott education. And we felt this was unfair, because since they are part of the struggle, or their philosophy, of which I disagree with greatly, is that liberation must come before education. I think it should have applied to them as well.
So in other words, this is just a slogan that they are mounting, but it really will be to the disadvantage, will be the long-term disadvantage of the black children.
Not only is it a disadvantage, it has literally wasted the future of these children. And the children have now realized that, and their parents have realized that. The parents are angry. We know the parents are angry. And it is now that they are seeking redress. And there have been threats bandied about, and we hope these threats won't be carried through against these leaders.
So you think that perhaps there is a backlash coming?
There's a definite momentum on this backlash coming on.
The backlash John spoke of is the rising tide of indignation from the black community against those self-appointed but non-elected black leaders such as Tutu, Alan Bozak, and Winnie Mandela, who banter the slogan "Liberation before education," thus depriving an entire generation of education, the best possible tool for improving their circumstances. Another problem facing South Africa is liberation theology. I asked Bishop Mokoena, spiritual leader of 4.5 million blacks, his opinion of liberation theology.
Well, it's a polarized gospel, which is being preached by Marxist-orientated people. They have now seized to the pulpits in the churches. They've infiltrated into the church, with the result the church in South Africa has tended to lose the gospel of reconciliation of man to God through Jesus Christ, and the reconciliation of man to man. Instead, the churches are preaching a gospel of social change, liberation theology, and black theology, which are not the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ, which calls men and women to total repentance. With this kind of gospel, the church has lost its prophetic voice and has become an open platform to propagate communism.
One of the darlings of the liberal media in the West is Winnie Mandela, wife of imprisoned Nelson Mandela. She speaks at large rallies of people and often incites her audience to violence.
This is now the right time to take your country. We shall use the same language the Boers are using against us. They know only one language, the language of the Kaspers. We have no arms. We have stones. We have boxes of matches.
The boxes of matches, she mentioned, referred to the practice of necklacing. Now, this is the act of putting an automobile tire around the neck of one whose hands are tied behind him with a wire. The tire is soaked with gasoline and set afire. The victim is then kicked and stoned in a long, slow, horrible death by burning. Many of the Africans are superstitious and believe in reincarnation. They believe that if you die by burning in this life, you return in the next one as an insect. So the death has not only traumatic physical horrors, but psychological ones as well. A 65-year-old black Anglican bishop criticized fellow Bishop Tutu on TV. Later, at home in the township, he was hauled before a kangaroo court held in a church and told by black radicals that he had 5 days to apologize or they'd necklace him and burn his home and family. Are you pleased, Winnie Mandela, that you put these inhuman ideas to your fellow countrymen? One day, Cindy, a former teacher in the black school system, took us in her car to Soweto, the black township southwest of Johannesburg. On the way, I asked her to explain some of the alphabetical terms we hear about, such as the UDF and the ANC, and to comment on the treatment these organizations get from the press.
Never in our newspapers is the truth exposed that the UDF is the United Democratic Front, is the internal wing of the African National Congress, a Soviet-backed terrorist organization controlled and run from the Kremlin. This organization, the UDF, causing all the trouble in South Africa, is always excused and put on a platform in South Africa, as is Mandela. He's termed statesmanlike, charming, personality, one in a million, a true leader of the African people, when in fact, as we all know, as documented in Judge de Villiers' book, at the time of the trial in Rivonia, he is a terrorist and he had terrorist ambitions to cause a revolution in this country and create as much bloodshed as possible, once again controlled by Moscow. This they choose to ignore.
And we'll find out why later on. It's important to point out that the communists do not want reform, they want revolution. To tear down and destroy everything, and then start over again with the new socialist man. The people of South Africa, black, white, colored, and Indian, want reform. The moderate government in Pretoria wants and is working hard to bring about reform. It takes time. But they're actually moving much faster than the United States did in moving from civil war to civil rights, or even from civil rights in the 60s to the present time. The most positive step forward was the inclusion of coloreds and Indians in the tricameral parliament. We had dinner at Parliament House in Cape Town on two occasions with cabinet members from each of the racial groups, who told us the new system is working very well. Reconstruction of the President's Council is now underway to include black representatives. In short, apartheid is dead. President Botha is in the unenviable position of not pleasing anyone, however. He's moving forward with reforms too fast for the right wing and too slowly for the radicals on the left. Every new reform is regarded as a threat by the former and only cosmetic by the latter. The radicals, trained and financed by the Communist African National Congress, realize that the last remaining vestige of apartheid is rapidly disappearing and have consequently stepped up their campaign of terror and intimidation in the townships, black killing black, before their issue is finally a dead one. The ANC is the armed wing of the South African Communist Party. Nelson Mandela, their hero, was tried and convicted for complicity in 153 acts of violence, sabotage, and destruction, which claimed many innocent lives. During his trial, Mandela never denied the charges. Now, many believe Mandela is more valuable to Moscow now by staying in prison and thus attracting international adulation. It's not a war of liberation, as Moscow and the ANC claim, along with much of the Western press. The black-on-black violence has turned most thinking black Africans against the so-called freedom fighters and sent them seeking white protection. When Pretoria responds with a state of emergency, the U.S. State Department screams, "Foul!" The way ahead is fraught with difficulties for all parties. A fair solution can only be found when violence and intimidation stop. A firm stand must be taken by the government through proper use of the police against all forms of terrorism. If the government displays weakness in this area, it would not help the vast majority who seek a solution soon. The real objective of the ANC is not the end of apartheid, but the violent overthrow of the South African government. Mr. Shapani realized this when he was a member of the committee of the South African Communist Party. After the ANC was hijacked by the Soviets, he realized that Marxism was not going to help his black people. He defected from the ANC and the South African Communist Party, and sometime later gave testimony before Senator Jeremiah Denton and the Subcommittee on Security and Terrorism. His testimony was published in November 1982, and the very next month, ANC thugs killed him, his wife and children, in their home in Soweto. We visited that home and talked with a surviving daughter, Pansy, who has been shot in the neck and left for dead. Today, she's a paraplegic, confined to a wheelchair, but courageously carrying on where her father left off.
It is a fundamental democratic principle that people will support a cause if they tell the truth.
General Sir Walter Walker, former NATO Commander-in-Chief.
If they can capture the two treasure houses of the world and do it by revolutionary war, by proxy, they can do it without a shot being fired in international war.
And General Walker identified those two treasure houses later that evening when he spoke at a banquet.
Moscow's intentions were clearly confirmed by Brezhnev, who said in 1971 to the Somali president, when Somalia was still an ally of the Soviet Union, again I quote, "Our aim is to gain control of the two great treasure houses on which the West depends, the energy of the Persian Gulf and the mineral resources of Central and Southern Africa."
The Soviets will go on expanding until they meet resistance, whether it is in Asia, Africa, Latin, or Central America. Somewhere, the line must be drawn. The West has lost Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. The communists are now south of the Zambezi. We can and should help the South Africans keep them north of the Limpopo. Instead, we have imposed sanctions on our best friends and allies in all of Africa. Mr. Otto Scott, in his book, The Other End of the Lifeboat, summarizes the complexity of the sanctions program this way.
We must remain aware of two facts. One, South Africa is not a United States colony, but a sovereign nation and our only ally in that region of the world. And two, punitive economic sanctions would harm not only the blacks and whites of South Africa, but also the economy and national security of the United States. Now, there are those who would dispute this. One man recently told me that he understood that all the minerals we need are available from Brazil. Where in Brazil, I asked, and he said, in the Amazon. Well, that's a big territory. Much of it is unexplored, for very good reason. The Amazon is probably the greatest river in the world, and its annual inundation is larger than that of the Nile. It discolors the ocean when it empties into that larger body for hundreds of miles out at sea. Vast mountains loom in the background, and I have little doubt that they contain many minerals. But the mining industry of South Africa is the most advanced in the world. It is owned mainly by the English and not the Afrikaners. The English advanced the interests of Cecil Rhodes and his partners when they won the Boer War. When that war took place at the end of the 19th century, the mines of South Africa were already sunk and shafted and machined and producing. Since then, they have been expanded, and tens of hundreds of thousands of blacks have been sent in for varying periods from neighboring black nations to work in those mines. The workers have half their pay taken by their home governments, for whom these revenues are crucial. The other half is sent to the families of the miners. It's delivered to their villages and handed to their wives and children. They are taught all their skills. This is a drill. This is how they work. This is a hammer. Some have become expert miners, it's true, but all were taught in South Africa. And beyond what we see when we visit a diamond or a gold mine or any other facet of the mining industry is only a piece of a great mosaic put together with high finance, with imported machinery over the best railroads in all Africa, unloaded and loaded in containers at Simonstown and other ports, processed and compressed and shipped to the markets of the world. Such sales are promoted by metallurgists and researchers and manufacturers and engineers and salesmen and bankers and transportation experts and brokers and administrators of every sort. My friend, a retired investment banker, said all this could be obtained from Brazil and the Amazon. Perhaps it can, if we have 60 years or so to do it. But if we, or the Brazilians, had the money to ship in thousands of miners and hundreds of specialists and experts, and multi-million dollars in equipment and earth-moving machinery and the like, and to set up docks and ships and trains and markets, we would really be miracle workers. All this flashed through my mind, but words failed me. What can you say to someone who lives in a mental world as remote from ours as Mars?
That is a problem, but some are beginning to wake up. After the Senate overrode the President's veto in October 1986 and imposed sanctions on South Africa, they began to feel the heat from pragmatic constituents across the country. Many areas of U.S. industry dependent on South African minerals would have to shut down. American jobs would be lost. The result? The following list of strategic minerals, vital to U.S. interest and security, and virtually unobtainable anywhere else, were exempted from sanctions. The list includes andalusite, antimium, chromium, cobalt, industrial diamonds, manganese, vanadium, and the platinum group metals. Now, the liberal left in this country decided not to oppose these exemptions lest the catastrophic domestic consequences be attributed to them. As a result, the media has quietly ignored these exemptions. But beyond the material aspect of sanctions, there is the human factor. To find out firsthand what sanctions mean to the blacks, the people we're supposed to help, I talked with Mr. Moise, a black Zulu Christian businessman, and asked him,
what is your reaction as a black man to these various different decisions that are being made by other people, most of whom have never been to your country and do not really understand?
My heart is very sad, thinking about these things that we have heard and seen, things that have been said and decisions that have been made that are actually going to destroy our lives. First of all, as a Christian, my heart is sad to see the Western world, the people that brought us the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. We don't say that the gospel belonged to them, but they were used to bring the gospel to us. Their forefathers brought us the gospel. And today, these very people are working to destroy that very work which their forefathers started, the good work which the missionaries have done for us. Now they have said, sanction South Africa. Because the blacks are suffering, so let them suffer more. To us, these sanctions and these decisions look like slavery. Because now we know that the Americans used to come and steal our people along the coast and made them slaves. So we are convinced that the Americans would still like to see the Africans suffering, to see them being killed, to see them being starved, just as they did it. Now, to us, we don't see it as a help, what they are doing. We see them still continuing with the slavery. Because now they say they are setting us free. But how can you set me free if you starve me to death? I just see that America and the Western world, Western Europe as well, they're just busy selling us to the Russians. Look at all Africa. Right up from the north downwards, they have been selling one state after the other. They are starving, they are dying. It is a sad thing to us. Yes, there are some things that must be changed, of course, and we appreciate the change, but we do not appreciate the selling of our people to communists.
And who is selling these people to the communists? Let's go back to our interview with Cindy on the way to Soweto.
Anglo-American now owns 90% of the English papers. The English newspapers are pushing a Marxist line. It adds up very simply that Anglo-American wants a Marxist takeover in this country. And if you consider what big companies have done in the rest of Africa and in the rest of the world, you'll understand that the trilateralists work in tandem with Marxist regimes. And at the present point in time in South Africa, I think it would suit Anglo-American to have a Marxist state here. People tend not to understand why, but if one does not have minimum wages anymore, if one does not have these trade unions, which are proving to be a bit difficult, if one does not have safety measures on mines and could just pay a puppet dictator a certain amount of money, a few million rand, and then get on to take all the money out of the country, they're going to be a bit happier than they are at the present moment.
Are you saying that there are no, that there is no minimum wage or safety regulations in the mines?
No, what I'm saying at the present moment in South Africa, we have minimum wage restrictions, we have safety measures on mines, very strictly controlled. The workers have to have their holidays, they have to be cared for, health facilities, pensions, everything has to be provided. What I'm saying is under a Marxist state, all these regulations fall away. There is no protection for the black worker at all. And in any Marxist state north of us in Africa, you can check any mine facility and you'll see that all these protections of the black man have fallen away, and the mines are simply screwing as much money out of the countries as they can for their own benefit.
Look at Mozambique, they are starving to death. Look at Angola, they are starving to death. The civil war, the people are dying there. And the Americans, the Europeans, they want the same thing to take place here. And I'd just like to ask the American people whether they have already printed Bibles for us. Because if communism takes over this country, we shall lose our Bibles. Have you printed Bibles for us? And by the way, did you know that there are about 10 different tribes or nations in South Africa? Blacks. Do you know their languages? Have you printed Bibles in their languages? Maybe you haven't. And when the communists have taken over, with all your hypocrisy, you will come and try and bring us Bibles, and you'll not even be able to pass through the border gates to bring them to the people that need them.
South Africa's problems are not simple ones. Neither are the solutions. It's a country of minorities. True, there are almost five times as many blacks as whites, but there are 10 different black nations. Each nation has its own language and form of government, a chief, a king, a president, and so forth. Each is proud of his own culture and customs. Most have their own special diet, which produces a unique body odor, pleasant to their own people, but offensive to those of other nations. The Xhosa, for example, might think the Zulu stink, and vice versa. True, there's poverty in some rural areas. A Christian Zulu farmer explained it this way. When I was converted to Christ, I gave up the worship of ancestral spirits. Ancestor worship has kept my people poor and in superstitious bondage. Now, Americans can understand bondage and superstition, but why would ancestor worship create poverty? Well, they're afraid to sell their cattle for fear of offending the spirit of some departed relative. One man we met had 3 bulls and 2 cows. Obviously, that was 2 bulls too many. He could have earned the equivalent of a year's income by selling 2 of the bulls, but he refused. Critics of South Africa point out that 75% of the population, which is black, have only 13% of the land. Now that seems unfair until you realize that most of South Africa is desert. The 13% given to the blacks represents 75% of the arable land. Now what did they do with their land? Overgrazing by surplus cattle they refuse to sell causes the soil to deteriorate and erode. If white farmers have even 1 cow over the allowed number per acre, they are heavily fined. Thus, black farms, where the government does not regulate grazing, look poor by comparison to the white farms immediately adjacent. The South African government has never endeavored to export its now dying policy of apartheid to other black African nations. Communists, on the other hand, seek not only to export their unworkable ideology, but to terrorize and intimidate target nations into accepting it.
You have starved us right now, and then when the communists have taken over, you will pretend that you are bringing the food for us and only give it to those people in power who will be taking it back to Russia to pay for the arms that they are using at present to kill and to necklace our own people.
It is unfortunate that responsible observers in the West respond so grudgingly to such promising developments as we see in South Africa today. But it is criminal when that negative response further complicates the internal affairs of a nation friendly to the West. Remember, we do not face the prospect of having to live with the consequences of what we advocate. They do. So apartheid is not the issue. South Africa is not our enemy. Sanctions are not the answer. All other black African nations, most of which have a one-party dictatorship, have their begging bowl out for Uncle Sam to support their tyranny. South Africa has a multi-party system with a tricameral government and asks for nothing but our goodwill. In return, she offers us uninterrupted, reliable supply of the world's most valuable minerals, plus unimpeded traffic around the Cape of Good Hope, the principal route for Mideast oil to the West. Winds of change are blowing in South Africa. If they are controlled and channeled in the reform process, as the present government in Pretoria is trying to do, then they will be a powerful generator of prosperity and peace for all. On the other hand, if the winds of change develop into a storm of revolution, then we'd better batten down the hatches in America, because that storm will sweep across Africa, Latin and Central America, and hit the United States with a devastating fury, sweeping away everything that we hold dear. It's only a matter of time, and it's already 1 hour nearer than when you began listening to this tape. Understanding Africa was written and produced by Bill Bathman. If you'd like further information, write to me, care of P.O. Box 28240, Tempe, Arizona, 85282.